Welcome to episode 199 of The Lab. I'm Brad Barton.
Yeah, I'm Phil Barton.
We have many links this time. It ought to keep you busy for a week. And if you'd like to follow those and learn more stuff, you can find them by visiting thelabwithbrad.com. Cool. More stuff.
Stuff. Yay, lots of links. Are we still talking about the brain?
We're still talking about the brain. You know, in the last episode, you kept asking, what is this episode about?
Yeah.
I never did give a topic sentence.
No.
So to speak. I took that out, by the way. I probably shouldn't have mentioned it, but
now you have to take it out again.
Well, today I want to talk a little bit about the brain and learning. And the different kinds of learning the brain does in different areas. This is a huge topic, so we're just going to cover a few highlights here and there.
I could use some help in learning. Like, is there a miracle way to instantly memorize all the shit I need to know? I mean, all these stuff that I need to know.
Well, that pause in the middle of what he was saying was a word that we don't use on this show. Right. Once upon a time, Paul and I went out to Silver Lake. And we were in kayaks.
Neat.
Right. I was in a touring boat. It's a bit longer than a whitewater kayak. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have the rails on the sides.
There's rails on the sides?
Sort of edges.
Okay. Well, anyways.
Yeah. I mean, it's there because the whitewater kayaks sort of sacrifice stability in order to be able to maneuver faster.
Also, you want to be able to flip back way, the right way up.
Yeah, it's funny you should mention that because we were there so that Paul could get his roll back.
Okay. Where did it go?
That's a good question. His instructor, you know, back when he was learning to do this in a swimming pool before he actually went kayaking, warned his students at some point, you may lose your roll.
Okay.
Now, what is a roll? Well, yes, sometimes when you're in a kayak, you get flipped upside down. And since we do like to breathe, you need to be able to flip the back up.
Yes.
So that's the roll, the move you do to get yourself back on top of the boat instead of being dragged along the gravel. Oh, or just God. Awful things could happen.
Yeah.
But he'd lost it, and you understand he had been actually on rivers, doing some actual whitewater kayaking by that point. But just one day, the roll was gone.
Weird.
Yeah, so we were out there on the lake. It was interesting to watch because several times he flipped back upside down, and instead of the boat coming back right up, there's Paul's head popping up. And, and he's cursing.
Probably cussing up a legacy, storm.
Yeah. So I got to wondering about this. Why would a skill just disappear like that? However, temporarily, he did get it by the end of the day. Got it back.
Mm-hmm.
I developed this theory that where you first learn something, the area in your brain may not be where the skill eventually lives permanently. And maybe switching over from one set of circuits to the more permanent ones sometimes doesn't go very smoothly.
Yeah.
So where did I get this notion from? Well, there are several places. Mm. Once upon a time ago, I read a book called Conversations with Neil's Brain.
Uh-huh.
Yes. In that book, it mentioned, quite casually, that amateur musicians tend to have areas associated with playing their music in the right hemisphere of their brain.
Mm-hmm.
Professionals, on the other hand, have the same circuitry on the left side of the brain, closer to the areas where we do language.
Ah.
So there's one example of where it seems to be going from one place to another.
Okay.
There's also something I saw on brain scans of meditators. And again, beginning meditators, there was a lot of activity in the right side of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
More seasoned meditators, the same sort of areas would light up, but they were now on the left side of the brain instead.
It's weird. I wouldn't think of meditating having anything to do with
any sort language. Of effort or anything.
Oh, you're just sitting there and being quiet.
Well, you know, just because it migrates over to the left doesn't mean it necessarily has anything to do with language. There have been a few other studies on music and language, and yeah, a lot of the same circuitry gets recruited. Language in particular, there's one. I had a notion in my head that children, when they first learn language, a lot of that circuitry is on the right side of the brain. And then as they get older, it migrates over to the left. And this was a this was a saga trying to confirm this. What I found out is that nobody's sure.
Okay.
Got a whole lot of conflicting reports. I'm actually going to put links to a lot of these, and you can go through and decide for yourself. Seems to be an ongoing debate. But there are a couple of little things about learning. It's not always entirely a conscious process. In fact, sometimes you can learn something you'd rather not have learned entirely unconsciously.
You mean like playing Japanese tapes in your sleep?
Well, presumably if you did that, you wanted to learn Japanese. You remember the cortical homunculus from last episode?
Sure. Sure.
These are areas associated with sensing your body and moving your body. And this is a very changeable part of your brain. It has to be, because you never know what you're going to have to learn to do physically. You might have to learn how to make your kayak roll.
Mm-hmm.
Something that can happen when you get a limb amputated is that other areas of the homunculus will grow in to that same territory. And you can end up with crosstalk. Another thing that could happen is that if you had a paralyzed limb for a couple of months and it was painful, they may amputate the arm in a misguided attempt to remove the pain. But by the time they've done that, your brain has already learned that that hand doesn't move and it hurts.
Crap.
They call it phantom limb pain.
Heard of this, yes.
Yes, I've actually got a link to a TED Talk by the guy who did this research. And yeah, he pointed out that if they were lost their arm fairly early on after the paralysis, they often could feel a phantom limb, but they could also move it.
Weird.
Yes, and so it didn't clench up and cramp up and hurt. And he theorized that it was actually your vision causing an association for all those months. Every time you consciously or unconsciously tried to move your arm and it didn't, you saw that it wasn't moving.
Yeah.
So he eventually came up with this experiment. And as a side note, talking about the face kind of growing into the arm area, he also did an experiment where he'd take a brush and lightly stroke the patient's face. And they often would describe it as like, well, that just went across my palm and part of my thumb.
Weird.
Yeah. But this part is the neat. Nifty part. This is the neat. Okay. I meant it. I was trying to coin a phrase.
Yeah.
Right. So
tell me about the neat.
I can't talk anymore. I can't even breathe. Okay. So to unlearn this, he thought he'd set up an experiment. He made a little box with a mirror in it. You look at one side with one eye and the other side with the other. You put your functioning hand in on the one side.
Yeah.
And you would see the mirror image. And he had the patient put his functioning hand in the same position that they were feeling the phantom limb in.
Yeah.
Like, for example, a clenched fist. Mm-hmm. And then a very vivid sensation would take place where the patient would go, "My limb is there. I can see it." And they're giggling, you know, they know it isn't really true. But then He had him had them imagine moving their phantom limb and doing the same motion with their real hand. So the real hand opens up. They imagine opening the phantom limb, and visually, they get feedback that says, that just happened.
Ha ha! Success!
Mm. And as a matter of fact, the pain went away. Now, these are all unconscious processes. Nobody's sitting there in their hospital bed going, well, I better be able to remember how this feels and hurts.
Yeah. Well, his theory was proven right, though.
Well, it supports
it. Or at least given some, yeah, supported.
Yeah, and it, yeah. Then we've got language.
Mm-hmm.
This is an interesting area of research. Because babies are better at learning languages than, say, you or I.
Yeah, I'm terrible at it. Oh, my goodness.
And there's a correlation, actually, that the older you are, the harder it is to acquire a second language. Well, I was watching a documentary called mm-hmm. Weird Wonders of the World.
Oh, okay.
Yes. A lot of these things the guy brought up, I'd heard of from other sources. But this was a new one on me. This guy, apparently, had learned a bit of Mandarin in high school, but wasn't very good at it. This is one of several languages that are floating around in China.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a native English speaker. He's from Australia. Anyway, he was in a car wreck, and when he woke up from the coma, he could only speak Mandarin.
What a wild experience.
Yeah. And that in itself is called bilingual aphasia. And in this documentary, the host sort of presented it like anybody who has bilingual aphasia might also suddenly get much better at the language, their second language. That's usually not a feature. Bilingual aphasia, you've got more than one language. Sometimes they both get impaired. Sometimes they recover together. Sometimes one recovers faster than the other. It's rare, but occasionally the second language will recover faster than the first one.
But if I remember that show correctly, it seemed like he barely knew Mandarin at all.
Yes, and, now and then he suddenly
he's making a living over there.
Yeah, he's hosting a talk show. The classic theory of bilingual aphasia is that the newer language is living in a different part of the brain. And that's what I was looking for. I was trying to see if I could confirm that.
Mm-hmm.
But various brain imaging studies don't seem to support that. At least not in a way you still get left side dominance for both languages.
Okay.
What you, in one area, the area where you understand it, you can't separate the two languages. There may be differences, but they're too slight to notice with our current measuring techniques.
Yeah.
On the other hand, the Brodmann area, up towards the front of the brain on the left side, you'll have one little eraser-sized chunk for the first language, and then very close to it is the eraser-sized chunk for the second one.
You mean like on the end of a pencil eraser?
Yes.
Eraser?
Yeah, that's about the size, yeah.
Tiny.
Enough to where if a injury affected one of those, you'd expect it to affect the other one.
Yeah.
And there are some other theories, dynamic ones and so forth. And the thing is, this is just the way it usually goes. Any given person might have some or all of their language processing on the right side of the brain instead of the left. Same with different languages. So there's no clear picture here.
It would be difficult to study. You'd have to wander around and bash people in the head.
You know? That's the thing. Bashing people in the head also causes another very rare syndrome called acquired savant syndrome.
Huh. Oh, suddenly good at something.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. An injury or a neurological condition hurts your brain. And then paradoxically, you suddenly become good at something you weren't good at before.
Like, is it actually savant level good at something? Because you say savant, it's like, you know, the guy that could hear a piano piece played through a radio once.
And then sit down and play it? Yeah, it actually does happen. There are some examples, some of the links of various savants who got their abilities after an injury. One guy was ended up being a calendar calculator. Like, if you give him any given date over the last umpteen years, he can tell you what day of the week that fell on. Now, you and I could learn to do this. There are various formulas, and with a little practice, we could do this. But the interesting feature about people with this condition is that they're not consciously trying to find the answer. It just pops in their head.
Just sort of know it.
Yeah, another interest. You get calculations, mathematical ability, sometimes increased artistic ability, visual or music, a lot of increased memory. Mm-hmm. Like, that same guy can also tell you what the weather was, if it's a date after the accident. He got hit in the head with a baseball.
Poor guy.
He was a little dut at the time.
Wow.
And that, most of the time, savant abilities, they usually come with some sort of impairments. And one of the impairments that's pretty common is language. But every now and then, a rare version of a rare condition, you get a linguistic savant. Like that.
So maybe one of these Mandarin guys. Too.
Yeah, I'm thinking he temporarily had acquired savant syndrome. And that's how he got much better in Mandarin. Because just bilingual aphasia would not make you better at it. Not by the dramatic increase that he apparently had.
Interesting.
It is interesting because it sort of suggests, especially since most of these injuries and conditions that bring on this kind of ability happen in about the same place, the left temporal lobe, that part of the brain is actually keeping you from doing things you otherwise could do.
So I should bash my head into a wall.
This is not like the Flintstones, right? You don't get hit on the head with a bowling ball and become a world famous car racer or whatever. This is not recommended to try at home, but there are some techniques that you could try at home at your own risk.
Oh, goodness. Pinpoint bashing. Take a nail. Oh, God. Never mind.
You wonder about the consciousness involved here. And does it sometimes actually get in the way of your learning?
Why would it? I mean...
Yeah, good question. I think one of the guys, I have a link both to the documentary about him and a talk that he did with his tutor for Icelandic. The documentary shows him doing various mathematical things. Specifically, what he got is synesthesia, so that numbers have color and texture and shape to him.
Does that help him solve problems?
As he describes it, when he's given a mathematical problem, he sees the shapes of the numbers, and then they sort of mix together and slowly resolve into a different shape, and then he reads the answer off of those shapes.
Weird.
Yes, he's also memorized more than 22,000 digits of pi.
All this without acid.
Without what?
Acid, you know.
Never mind.
I totally thought that's what you said we should do.
This is how I learned math.
We do not condone drug use of any kind. That's the part that interests me, because any given savant ability can be matched by a normal person. But they have to learn the techniques and train and practice for an extended period of time. It's this apparent effortlessness of the talent and the way it just sort of appears that is fascinating.
Very attractive. I like instant gratification. Yeah.
Well, yeah, so there's some oddities in the way we learn and how our brain is able to absorb information and maybe not even share it with us.
Right. There's a lot more going up in my head than I am ever privy to.
I don't think I want to know everything that's going on in my head.
Me neither.
Next time, episode 200. To celebrate, I'm not planning anything. We'll see what happens. I mean, there's going to be a free form. Well, actually, I have some plans about what I want to talk about. So I'll probably cheat and prepare anyway.
As free form as this blocked out structure.
This is so free form. Here are the following syllables I will be using. Oh, all right. That's for next time, and we'll see you then.
Bye.